The following interview is part of the American Phytopathological Society Centennial Oral History Project. In this interview, Milton Zeitlin and Karen Beth Schultoff discuss the relationships between the disciplines of plant virology and plant pathology, as well as the career of Dr. Zeitlin. Milton Zeitlin is an emeritus professor in the Department of Plant Pathology and Plant Microbiology at Cornell University. During his career, Dr. Zeitlin has made critical contributions to our understanding of plant-infecting viruses, including tobacco mosaic virus. Dr. Zeitlin was interviewed by Dr. Karen Beth Schultoff, a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology and Microbiology at Texas A&M University. Dr. Schultoff's research focuses on the molecular biology of Panicum mosaic virus and its satellite virus, SPMV. This interview was recorded at Cornell University in December 2007.
How did you get interested in working with plants, or did you come from it from a chemistry background or more of a plant biology background?
Well, let me go back a little with some history. In the Navy, where I served about a year and a half, I was in electronics. I thought that would be a wonderful career. Well, I went back to school and found out that was not for me. And it was very difficult to decide what to do. And at that time, the Veterans Administration gave aptitude tests, 2 days' worth of aptitude tests. And they said, well, you'd be good for some sort of a lab science and good with plants. Well, so when I was at Berkeley, I looked at what... I can't remember why I chose plant pathology, to be honest with you. But after going there, I got my degree, and you had to find a job. So I applied to the Citrus Experiment Station in Riverside. That's now University of California at Riverside. And they offered me one of two jobs. The first one was a lab technician for Zentmeyer, a very famous plant pathologist. And the other was to work on the smog project. And I chose this for the trivial reason that I was living in Los Angeles and I didn't have to move. A friend of mine, Irv Schneider, who we had been undergraduates together at Berkeley, he was offered a job by the head of the Division of Plant Industry of the CSIRO in Australia. At that time, Australians were not giving PhDs, and so they were looking for people. And so this fellow came to this country to recruit, and he had recruited Irv Schneider, who really didn't want to go to Australia. After that, he got a job offer at the Illinois Natural History Survey, and so he felt morally obligated to find someone to take his place,
yeah.
And so he contacted me. And it turned out to be a marvelous experience because they agreed if you stayed 3 years, they would pay your fare and your family's fare, both going and coming. The downside of it was the salary was so low that you really pauperized. If you didn't have a housing allowance, I think you would have starved to death there. So as a consequence, you couldn't do a lot of traveling and so forth.
Yeah.
But once again, met some wonderful people. And my career really shifted a lot when one of the fellows on some of my paper, Keith Boardman, and Paul Whitfeld, they came and I started to collaborate with them. Because I think I explained to you, when I got there, I was in a section called plant pathology, and the head was a man named K.O. Müller. He had been a German scientist who discovered phytoalexins. But he didn't have much interest in viruses, and so I had this big lab with nothing in it and a full-time technician. And you don't think that was a trauma to, you know, what do you have this technician do?
Right.
I wasn't clear myself, what do I want to do? And I did flounder a lot. I did the paper I see you have there about electrophoresis, separating strains. That was sort of a side issue. But then when Whitfeld and Boardman came, and Boardman had come from getting his degree in England, he was a wonderful, sharp guy, and he had been working on chloroplasts and decided that was something worth being interested in. I went to the APS meeting in Mexico City. I think it was 72, I think, or maybe 71. I think it was 72. I met Durwood Bateman, who was at the time the chair here, and said they were looking for a senior person because Frank Ross, whom you know, had health problems and he had to retire early. And it turns out I've learned I was not the first person to whom they offered the job, but that's okay. So,
at least you didn't have to apply.
Yeah, no, but I had to give a seminar and all that sort of stuff. And I must say, I have to speak highly of Cornell. They've been very good to me. I not only was a professor here, I was also an administrator. I was running I started the biotech program with some other people, and I was once its director. So, and these are very rewarding experiences. And Cornell, even in retirement, they're very good to you. They give you this office, and even if you wanted a lab, you could have it. But I didn't want it, because at the time I turned 70, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Grants were hard to get. Mm-hmm. And although I've been very successful over the years, I had been actually the panel manager for the USDA Competitive Grants Program. The next year I got turned down from the same panel that I had run. Anyway, so, and there was a financial crisis here, and they had to give back some money to the dean, and so they would have had to fire people, so I thought, well, I'll just retire. And it was a good move.
So I didn't realize that you actually founded the biotech?
I was one of the founders here, yeah.
Center or program on campus?
Yeah. What happened there was that the state of New York decided they wanted to have centers of excellence. And they had a competition, and proposals were written, and they had a panel of the National Academy. It was sort of a sham, I think, but Cornell was going to get one for sure. Mm-hmm. Originally, there were 7 of them. Now they were presumably established on a scientific basis. Subsequently, they've had about 5 more on a political basis. This is a very political state, you know. People with influence get their influence felt. So
developing this program, I mean, did that lead directly to the building?
Yes.
Being put up, and can you talk a little bit more about, I mean, why you got interested in biotech program and what your hopes were for that?
Going back, I'm not sure. I was asked by the guy who was really the founder, Gordon Hamas, who's a professor of chemistry. Now he's at Duke. They gathered some people, and I can't remember why they chose me, but we were in on the original proposal writing. And then when we got it, they asked me to stay on. I was associate director there for a long time. And it was a good program. We used most of the money to give research grants to people. And then we had this unusual circumstance where one year the Army had a research grant program that they told us later was foisted on them by Congress. It lasted 1 year. But it was about $14 million, and we won it. And it was presumably competitive. So that enabled us to buy lots of equipment, and we had a big program. It was a big deal.
So you mentioning Japan reminded me that I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the protoplast work and especially the work that Takabe and Atsuki did in the late 60s, showing that not only could they make protoplasts, but they could infect them. And if you could talk about your earlier attempts with that, and also their work and your visit to Japan to see the methods.
Okay. Well, one of the things that was really hindering plant virus research was the capacity to do a single round of replication. when you work with a leaf, you say infect the leaf, you infect a very few cells, they infect other cells. And so it's very difficult to study the early events that take place. So the ideal thing would be to have a single cell. And I recognized that a long time ago. And I had worked with people. We were able to, in fact, one of my early papers, we had looked at pectic enzymes, and we were able to separate cells. But still, it couldn't really infect them. They had cell walls on them. So we wanted to make protoplasts, and I never realized that to make a good protoplast, and you could get enzymes that would take the wall off, okay? But I didn't realize that there had to be a hypertonic solution. I don't know why. I never did that. I always had isotonic solutions. I never was able to do it. Anyway, I went to a meeting in Japan. I don't even, you know what the
Let's
year
see.
Was.
Yeah, 1967.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one of my friends said, you know, he knew that I had been doing this kind of stuff. He said, you should go down to Chiba. There's a guy there who works with protoplasts. And I did, and it was a guy, this fellow, Takabe. And he did absolutely brilliant work. I mean, he used hypertonic solutions. And not only that, he found chemicals that you had to apply that would enable the virus or the nucleic acid to get in the cell. It was a remarkable piece of work.
So, I as you mentioned in the a plug for our TMV anthology, that it really was transformative. That I mean, it allowed us to really get going, I think, full speed on what is replication and what's required for movement, all these...
Sure. I mean, not just me, but throughout the virus world, that was very quickly adopted. And people were able to make protoplasts from all kinds of leaves, infect them with different viruses. That was a really important paper.
So the... from that, so things sort of start coming together, because I think about the PM1 and 2 mutants again, and then looking at encapsidation. And if maybe if you could just comment on sort of some of the highlights from your work of sort of these critical moments for TMV or for virology.
A lot of things we did, like your mentor, Andy Jackson, was there in Tucson, and we were still working with separated cells. And what we could do, once again, we knew about protoplasts, but they're very hard to make them. I never could do it well. So we would take these separated cells from infected leaves, and we did a lot of work to show what products, by labeling, what products are produced as a result of virus infection. You could treat them with actinomycin D, which inhibited a lot of the host metabolism, nucleic acid synthesis. And then, so we were able to do that sort of study. And subsequently, later on, these things developed into a lot of studies with in vitro translation to decide what products are produced. And in that study with Andy Jackson, we uncovered the concept of this subgenomic messenger RNA, that the virus's coat protein was produced on its own subgenomic messenger RNA.
And that was what Andy named LMC.
LMC, low molecular weight component, he called it. And then later on, like George Bruning came to my lab, and we really exploited that. There was a strain of, it's a Tabamo virus, was called a cowpea strain. It's, once again, a separate virus, but it had the unusual property of actually encapsulating the RNA that was used for the messenger for coat protein. And so that was really a good way of understanding all of that. And then we uncovered a number of other RNAs that were used to translate the replicase was full length, mm-hmm. and the so-called 30K, the movement protein, and this 54K protein, which has never been isolated yes. by anybody.
So I'd say that you know, one of many of your great claims to fame will indeed be the 54K yeah. protein message. So where, how would you sum up the? I mean, there's been there seem to be some functionality associated with it, but what?
Well, it's part, you know, it's the read-through part of the replicase. I can never find it in the plant, but one of my students, Mike Solzinski, actually found it on polyribosomes, the messenger RNA, which would suggest to you that it is, in fact, translated. But as far as finding it, we've never been, and I tried really hard, and other people looked for it, and it's sort of poo-pooed. As a scientist, a lot of what you do is a result of the people who come to work with you. And I think I've been really fortunate having great ones. And like George Bruning, what a man he is. He's such a superb scientist, a hard worker. And a few others I've had, like Peter Paliokaitis. He came first to my lab as a postdoc, then he became a research associate, and then he got on to the faculty here. And he, too, was a very hard worker, a brilliant guy. And I've had overseas visitors, some of whom have done very well. Irvin Balaj came. George Lomonosov came. And that was a real trauma for him. He doesn't fly. He has to come by the QE2. And he spent a year here. And a few others. So it was... been very good, and it's been wonderful.
So, yeah, so some of the other people. So, Jim Scholes. Who I've known since graduate school, he also came through.
Yeah, he was here only for about a year. Right. Yeah, got a good job in Missouri.
And,
Jim Hodenshield, he's gone. I don't know where he is now. Yeah.
And as one of the visitors, can you talk a little bit about Richard Fransky?
Yeah, Fransky came to Cornell twice, first with me and the second time with Peter Paliokaitis. He, too, was a superb scientist and died way too young of colon cancer. He was a wonderful guy to have. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of these are lifelong friends. I first met him, you know, when I was in Australia in the 50s. So. And he made his good career for himself at the Wade Institute.
I guess, commentary or your impressions of the time of when the TMV was sequenced fully and then when the first infectious transcripts were generated, and some of Bill Dawson's work, if you could comment on that a little bit.
Yeah, well, probably, I think the most epoch-making thing recently is RNAi, which, as you know, certainly revolutionizes our capacity to control diseases, not just with viruses, but with other organisms. So that's a real breakthrough. But, you know, in terms of trying to find out the nuances of virus replication, a lot of that's been done. So I don't know what I would do if I were a young person starting out today. I don't know what I would do.
So do you think you would work on TMV?
Now?
Yeah.
Probably not. I mean, what else are you going to learn about it? I don't know. I think the main thing that I see that isn't really understood is how it affects its host, how it causes symptoms and that sort of thing. And that was one thing that even at the end of my career, I had this woman, Nandita Banerjee, and we were working once again on chloroplasts and things of that nature. But you know, where the interactions between the virus and the host genome are, I think there are some clues as to what's happening, but it's really not that well understood. But I, honest with you, I don't know what I'd do.
if you can just maybe give a brief bio of where I was born and the journey west.
80 years ago in Mount Vernon, New York, I was born. And I lived there till I was 8. My father was a dentist, and he developed asthma, so we had to leave that climate and find something better. So we first moved to Tucson, and we spent 2 years there. Tucson was a little town of about 30,000 people, dirt roads and stuff. But that didn't work well either, so we went to L.A., and that's where I went to school and so forth. My father would have been really keen for me to be a dentist. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, it was very tough in those days to get into professional school because there was this tremendous backlog of veterans from World War II who were getting into school. And dental schools, believe it or not, had weird requirements. I remember one of them I couldn't apply to. You had to have a course in music. Anyway, so I only applied to one, and I was an alternate to the class, and I'm very grateful that I didn't get in. Because I think you would have made a lot more money, I suppose, but it was not something that I would have enjoyed doing. So, although I'm pretty good with my hands, so anyway, so that's the story.